Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. I just got back, as a matter of fact, just got off a plane, drove to the studios here in San Francisco, rainy San Francisco. I was in New York City and Washington, D.C. for the past 10 days. Last week, we had a protest in front of the CIA. When I say we, I mean Peace of the Action Coalition. PEACE of the action. And we were protesting the CIA's illegal and immoral use of drones in regions like Pakistan. And Dick Cheney just happens to live about 10 minute walk from the CIA. So we walked over to his house. We tried to get the couple dozen of police that were joining us to help us arrest him. We were not successful. One of these days, I think that these criminals will pay, and we're going to still work for justice. And then the next day, we found out that the Air and Space Museum in the Smithsonian Institute has a drone exhibit, and it has drones that have actually bombed people hanging off the ceiling of the Air and Space Museum. And the company that builds the drones, General Atomics, sponsors the exhibit. So we hung a banner saying drones kill kids. And you can see videos of our protest, and you can see a video of the banner drop at peaceoftheaction.org. That's PEACE of the action.org. Well, today we're going to be talking a lot about a subject that we don't bring up too often. Recently, the Supreme Court rendered a horrible decision in the United Citizens versus the Federal Elections Commission, which basically gives corporations way more say in our election system than they had before, and they had a lot of say before. And also, right before that decision, there was a decision handed down about Mumia. Well, next week, I'm hoping to have someone on. We can talk about United Citizens v. the Federal Elections Commission. And today we're going to have Mumia's attorney, Robert Bryan, on to talk about his case and talk about the recent Supreme Court decision. So when we come back, we'll be talking to Robert Bryan. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the rob class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the rob class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
In the studio today, our guest is San Francisco attorney Robert Bryan, and Robert is Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney. Robert, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, thank you, Cindy. It's actually an honor to be here with you. And on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was just thrilled when we had a conference yesterday afternoon that I was going to be seeing you today. And so I'm saying I'm honored both for myself, but certainly on behalf of Mumia.
I also would like to do something and get on a list to go and visit him. Pam Africa is supposed to be giving me the details, and I know how busy she
well,
is.
That, no, well, that has to, setting up visits like this are far better through me as his lawyer.
Okay.
So I'll be glad to help you. Okay. I'm sure Mamiya would be thrilled to see. It's complicated, but we can work it out.
Right. Well, I'd be delighted to go visit him. So I told my listeners that you are Mumia Abu-Jamal's lawyer. How long have you been Mumia's attorney?
Well, I actually started representing Mumia in early 2003. However, he first wrote me in 1985. That's how many years ago? 1985. That's a long time.
25.
yes. And family members, supporters, people were flying out from New York and Philadelphia to San Francisco to meet with me. My office, this is in the late 1980s. And Mamie and I finally met on my late mother's birthday, April 15, 1991. And it was great. And he wanted me to take over the case. And, you know, my wife, Nicole, and I, flying back to San Francisco, I was looking at my calendar, and I said, you know, we've got so many death penalty cases, we cannot save the world. So okay. I reluctantly, one of the saddest letters I've ever written, wrote Mamiya, and this is 1991, and said, you know, I'd love to represent you, but I just do not have the time right now. I've got too many other death penalty cases.
Right.
And so then he came back to me, I guess around 2002, and his case was just totally in shambles, and it had not, and he had problems not only because of what the prosecution was doing, but because of his own lawyers just dropping the ball, not raising issues, not investigating things that I, as a death penalty specialist, would know to do. And so, this time around, I decided I guess I did it for selfish reasons, partially, and that is I like to sleep at night, and
right.
I could not sleep with myself and walk away from him a second time.
Absolutely.
And so, but he and I have actually known each other, beginning with correspondence now, for 25 years. That's a long time as I think about it.
It's amazing when you look back and realize how much time has passed by for things. But familiarize or refresh my listeners' memories about Mamiya's case.
Well, Cindy, Mamiya was arrested on December 9, 1981 in downtown Philadelphia, accused of killing a white cop who one of the things the prior attorneys never developed, but we have indications of, was a real dyed-in-the-wool racist, I mean, to the extreme, like to stop and beat up some poor black person walking down the street, African-American person.
Right.
None of that has ever come out in the proceedings. But he was tried in 1982 before a judge, Albert Sabo, who had sentenced more people to death at the time than any other judge in the United States.
Wow.
And this guy was straight out of central casting for a Southern racist, even though the trial was in Philadelphia. Mamiya was actually sentenced to death in 1983. He was convicted in 82, but the formal sentencing wasn't until 1983. The trial was the biggest trial in the history of Philadelphia. The courtroom was packed with cops who were packing their six irons, their
right.
guns. The judge, later it was discovered that the judge during the trial, this Judge Sabo, said to another judge during a recess, and I will quote the judge, not my language. I find this very offensive.
Right.
I'm going to help them fry the nigger, referring
right.
to Mamiya
right.
and talking about seeing that the prosecution gets its just desserts and Mamiya is executed. And now this is the judge who is presiding over the case, which is astounding. I said in a speech 2 weeks ago in Berlin for a very large crowd, and I think it's worth repeating, that everything that could go wrong in a capital case occurred in Mamiya's case. It's a smorgasbord of unfairness, how the judicial system can be so terribly unfair. It was permeated with racism. Mamiya did not have funds to hire a good lawyer, did
right.
not have funds to employ experts in fields like forensics. He wasn't able to afford an investigation. He had this monstrous judge sitting on the bench. The prosecution used racism and jury selection and other aspects of the trial, and it was just justice was on holiday during the trial of Mumia. And what's interesting, and I'd like to point out, mm-hmm. is that this type of thing does occur in many other cases. Some poor man or woman in Mississippi or Texas, but they do not get the publicity that Mumia's gotten. And but I think people need to bear that in mind, that he's become a symbol of what's wrong with our legal system, and particularly when it comes to trying to kill people.
Right. And I've had members of the San Francisco 8 on my show, which is very similar to Mumia's case, Black Panthers, working in the community to actually combat police brutality, police on African-American brutality. Mumia was a journalist. He's a college, I'm not sure if he ever got a degree, but
he actually has a degree now from college, university, and also has a master's degree.
And we have a treat for my listeners. We're going to air one of Mumia's podcasts. Mm-hmm. After our interview, very articulate, very well spoken, very knowledgeable about the issues, and it's about Haiti. Ah. His podcast.
Yes, I've heard that one. Mumia has, at the time of his arrest, you mentioned his being a journalist, was already recognized as the voice of the voiceless.
And he was a cab driver at the time, also
part-time. To support his family, his wife and children. But Mumia was known as the voice of the voiceless because he spoke out on behalf of the poor, the dispossessed, the disenfranchised. And he was the one who was saying the emperor wears no clothes. He was the one who was talking about corruption. And when he would see it, he would broadcast it. He would write about it. And the authorities told him in Philadelphia, one of these days we're going to get you. And when this case occurred, it was a railroad from then on until he arrived on death row, which is where he's been for nearly three decades.
Well, and I was reading about the case, re-familiar. That's a hard word to say when you haven't gotten any sleep. Refamiliarizing myself with it. And since then, witnesses have recanted. Yeah. I read something interesting that somebody actually – tell me about this. Somebody actually confessed.
That was something. I mean, there's a lot of evidence, and I hate to talk about that because there's a lot of evidence of the unfairness of the trial, of it not being, should not be a murder case.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something that somebody drummed up and got this guy to say, and it actually, the movement for Mumia lost a lot of credible support because of this mm-hmm. guy. Because what he said made no sense.
Well, maybe he was sent to do that then.
But there's other evidence. There's a lot of other evidence out there in the same area that's of great significance. I think it's interesting when they put Mumia on death row, they thought they would shut him up and silence his pen as a journalist.
Right.
In fact, ironically, he's become better known, as heard by more people today. We're talking about him now, when he was free. He's written six books from death row,
mm-hmm.
One of them about the history of the Black Panther Party, in which he was a leader and very active.
And he has a podcast, like I said, at Prison Radio.
Right. It's actually broadcast by many stations, both here in the United States and in Europe. And also his broadcasts are transcribed, and they appear in papers even in Germany,
mm-hmm.
in France, in England. So he's reaching a lot of people, and rather than being quiet and trying to play the game and be a nice person to avoid being executed, Mumia continues to speak out with great passion, as you do,
mm-hmm.
About injustice. And somebody asked me not too long ago, well, since you're trying to save his life, Robert Bryan, how would you, if you had a choice, would you try to muzzle him a little bit? And I said, absolutely not. That's what part of making Mumia what he is, a very special and very, I think, a lovable person. He's just wonderful. Is that they can't shut him up. And he doesn't want to die. People need to understand that.
Right.
But by the same token, he's not going to shut his mouth and put his pen down in order to spare himself.
Well, we can't. If we really believe in something and if we have that dedication, that commitment, and you know, the overwhelming urge to make positive change, it doesn't matter what happens to us. We can't sell out. We can't stop. We can't stop talking. We have to, if we speak out and speak the truth, we have to also accept whatever consequences might come. And that takes a lot of courage, especially for somebody who's in Mumia's position. I was just in New York City, and I went to a trial, the opening remarks of a Pakistani woman, Afia Siddiqui. Have you heard of her case?
Yes, I have.
And she's obviously being railroaded. Without going into the details, people can go to freeafia.org if they want to read, and that's AAFIA.org if they want to read the details. A Pakistani woman who is being accused of shooting trying to shoot some U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, and she actually was the one that got shot. Obviously, she's being railroaded, but she won't be quiet. She won't be quiet because she doesn't have a voice. She knows she's being railroaded, so she stands up to the judge, and she stands up to her lawyers and the prosecutors. And in our system, people call that crazy when people are just trying to defend themselves.
Well, and that's what Mumia is all about, and that's the passion of his life. Mumia would not be the person that he is. I mean, his whole existence revolves around addressing, as you do, his whole life is about addressing issues and trying to make the world a better place. I mean, he writes about women's issues, about poverty, about the importance of education, about racism. Mm-hmm. He never writes about himself, incidentally. He never talks about him, promotes himself. It's always causes and issues that he considers bigger than himself.
Right, right. Well, when I announced that I was going to be interviewing you to talk about what the Supreme Court did this past week, most of my supporters, my friends, the people who follow my show and follow what I write, also, most of them say free Mumia, but there's some people who say fry Mumia. Mm-hmm. And these are people on the so-called left. And I just want for you to tell my listeners exactly what happened this past week in the Supreme Court.
We've been in the U.S. Supreme Court. I've been in the United States Supreme Court. And I might point out that there's some other lawyers back east who are assisting me. I'm the lead attorney, mm-hmm. but it's not just me. We've been in the Supreme Court 15 months litigating the issue of the death penalty. And that is that the judge in this case, the trial judge, gave instructions to the jury in the penalty phase, which were unconstitutional, which were misleading to the jury. And a case that hit the Supreme Court, and I won on this case in the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, Philadelphia, before a three-judge panel.
Right.
They ruled unanimously that we were entitled to a jury trial on the issue of life or death. We got a new trial. The prosecution took that to the Supreme Court, and that's where we've been for the past year and a half. A case hit the court just before Smith versus Spezak out of Ohio, that was similar. The issue's similar, even though the facts are different. And so that case was accepted for what is referred to as certiorari. A certiorari petition was granted. There was oral argument, and a week and a half ago, the Supreme Court ruled, and it reversed that case. And what happened in that case was the same as ours, and it said that it was okay what the judge did in that case, which was stunning. And so then once that decision was made, then the court ruled in ours. And what the court did is sent our case. It vacated the victory I had achieved in the lower federal court, sent Mumia's case back to the lower federal court, the U.S. Court of Appeals, with instructions that the case be relitigated, reviewed, briefed, orally argued in light of this recent decision, Spezak. Mm-hmm. So we're back at square one on the issue of the death penalty. Mumia is still on death row. He's still under death judgment, and that hasn't changed in nearly three decades.
Right.
And so we're now into beginning a second round of very complex litigation and eventual oral argument in the Third Circuit in Philadelphia. And the Supreme Court's doing, as we know from some other cases, and you and I were talking about it just before we went on the air, with this new right-wing, relatively new majority of Roberts and Thomas and et cetera, it's doing some things that I think anyone with a and one doesn't have to be left, anyone with a sense of concern for human rights must be troubled by.
Well, and that's what I'm talking to my friends who say, fry him. I say, you know, it's not about judging whether Mumia is guilty or innocent. It's about fairness. It's about
exactly.
transparency. It's about justice.
Right.
It's about giving him a fair trial. And what would have happened if he actually had a fair trial to begin with?
Right, right. Had he had a good lawyer, investigation,
right.
et cetera, and there wasn't the racism and so forth. And the issue that we're focusing on now, out of necessity, and Mumia is focusing on, is wants to focus on, of course, is the death penalty. But with that comes the racism, the unfairness, et cetera, the bias of the trial judge, and so forth. And so I sometimes encounter some resistance even on the left from people who say, why should he be getting all of this attention and so forth? And I said, well, he's supposed to be executed. That's one reason.
Right.
And he has become, and people need to bear this in mind, that Mumia has become a symbol globally, not just in the U.S., but globally in the fight against capital punishment, against the death penalty.
Right.
And there are over 20,000 men, women, and children on death rows around the world, and he has become, unwittingly, it wasn't by choice, but he has become, because he articulates things so well, he's become the voice of the voiceless, more so than ever before. And let's don't even, you said it doesn't matter whether he did it or not. We're talking about fairness. We're talking about the death penalty. And I could not agree more. That's exactly what we're talking about. I might point out that we started.
Well, first of all, we can't judge whether he did it or not. I didn't sit on the jury. I didn't sit in the courtroom, you know. So we and if we did, he didn't get a fair trial anyway.
Right. And Cindy, he could be absolutely innocent.
He could be absolutely innocent.
Or he could have pulled the trigger in self-defense. This racist cop was beating Mamiya's brother with a 2-foot-long heavy steel flashlight. And Mamiya came running across the street, and the cop actually turned around and shot Mamiya
in the chest.
Right. Mamiya nearly died.
Right.
So he could be absolutely innocent. It could have been self-defense.
Could be being set up.
Or he could be set up. Right. Exactly. But But that's not the issue now.
Not the issue
is
at all.
The fairness, it's the death penalty. And I started a week ago an online petition for President Obama. And we already, as of today, have over 11,000 signatures. Now, we're you know, and most of those are coming out of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming out of Germany and France, but we're getting signatures from really globally, South Africa, Australia. India, Pakistan. The petition is in 10 languages. It's in English, French, German, Spanish, Italian, Urdu, Arabic. It's a global effort. And the first signer on the petition, number one, is Madame Danielle Mitterrand, the former First Lady of France. Okay. Gunter Grass, Nobel Prize winner, signed the petition. A number of other very notable people have signed the petition. And Bishop Desmond Tutu, South Africa, Nobel Prize winner, signed and is very involved with us in what we're doing, as is Madame Mitterrand. She was one of my co-conspirators, I remember, in various meetings in France and even one in Berlin with her, in planning this petition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really caught on, and it's now we want to strike a match under the people in the U.S., and that's beginning to happen. So,
where can people go to see that? Well, they can go to my website. We'll link CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We'll put a link about the petition, but if you can give the website.
Well, they can also go to the Mamiya Legal Defense website. It's MamiyaLegal.org or MamiyaLegalDefense.org. And when you get the legal page on the left side, you'll see a link. People will see a link to it just as you'll have on yours. And we need people really involved in this. We need organizations reaching their members. It's really important not only to the fight to save Mamiya's life, but also to all of those men, women, children on death rows around the world. So it's a very crucial effort.
Well, you are an expert in the death penalty. You're a death penalty attorney. How do you see the status of the death penalty in the U.S.?
I think the support for it, and I'm going to use a phrase that a good friend of mine came up with some years ago. The support is a mile wide, but only an inch deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's very thin. It's very wide, but in America. I think it's shifted in recent years. It's not as strong as it was because people now realize that innocent people get executed.
Right.
They realize that a lot of people wind up being executed not because they necessarily committed the worst crimes, but because, like Mamiya, they were poorly represented,
mm-hmm.
had no money, were the wrong color, had the wrong political beliefs. And
when's the last time a multimillionaire or a billionaire was executed here?
It does not happen.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't. And a warden many years ago said the death penalty is a privilege reserved for the poor.
Right.
And I thought that was just, he really hit the nail on the head with that.
Well, I just wrote a book called Myth America, The 20 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class in the Case for Revolution. And in my myth that the death penalty is a deterrent to crime, I actually quote some statistics from sheriffs who say that it's not effective, and it's in fact one of the most expensive tools they have, and they have much cheaper tools to prevent crime. And you know, it's more preventative, not punitive, is much cheaper.
Wow.
And cost wise, we were talking about the Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, and certainly the right wing flavor of the court played into that in a 5-4 decision. However, in Mumia's case, that wasn't a split decision, was it?
Well, we don't know what the vote was. What the court did,
it was a summary.
They just rendered an order on the heels of Spisak, which came mm-hmm. the week, you know, 5 or 6 days before this order. And in Spisak, it surprised me that the court was unanimous. Now, there were some separate opinions. But even Sotomayor voted with the majority
in
that case. And that surprised me because at oral argument in the Spisak case, which again has an issue very similar to what is in our case, she was asking some questions which would lead one to the belief that she felt very uncomfortable with that issue. She felt it did not even belong before the court. And there are a lot of politics behind the scenes, and maybe she saw that she was on the losing side, and so why go out on a limb on that case when she could save her political capital for another case to try to persuade some justices to go with her? Mamiya and I were, as a matter of fact, discussing this very issue this past week, and I thought his insight was quite good on it. But we don't know what the vote was in sending our – there's no way to know. It was an order which said the issue was what the order said is the petition for a writ of certiorari is granted. That's the prosecution's petition. The judgment is vacated. That's the lower court judgment, which ordered a new jury trial. We won. And the case is remanded to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit for further consideration in light of Smith versus Spezak, the case I was talking about. So regardless of what happens in the Third Circuit, whoever loses, and I think I can win again on this issue, the losing side will go back to the U.S. Supreme Court. And
how often can that cycle be repeated?
Oh, well, this would be it. This would be it. What frightens us, and people need to realize that this decision on Mamiya's case is a wake-up call, should be a wake-up call, because it actually moves him closer to being executed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless I uncover something extraordinary that opens up a whole nother issue, if we lose on this, he's dead.
Will you... chances are you could win in back in the circuit court and get kicked up back to the Supreme Court, and they've already ruled against.
And they could rule against us again. And then in that event, if they granted cert, prosecution cert petition, and denied relief as they did recently in Spezak, then that would be it. We would be headed towards an execution. In the meanwhile, Mamiya remains on death row. The power of what I do, this case is won or lost in what I do and my associates do in litigation. However, I think we've had problems before with this case, and I knew this when I took it 7 or 8 years ago, finally agreed to take it after decades, was that there was a problem in how Mamiya was perceived. And that affects how judges – I'm not saying a judge, he or she would sit down and say, I'm going to rule against Mamiya. Well, I do not like him, or I do not like this or that about him. But it affects – they're human.
Right, they're
human.
And
affects how they perceive things. And that's why the movement – one of the reasons, and there are others, but one of the reasons a good, credible movement is so important in this case because it creates a more favorable client. I know Angela Davis well, as I'm sure you do, and I remember once Angela telling me that, you know, when, in my trial years ago, because there was a good movement, and it was very credible, I think that made a big difference with the jury and the judge. And the judge in her case, Richard Arneson, who was specially assigned to her case, he's in Martinez in Contra Costa County. I recently did a death penalty case with great success before him. And I remember one day him telling me that he said, you know, of all the people I've dealt with, I remember sitting down with Angela and I allowed her to co-represent herself with her lawyers, and which is unusual. And he said, I said, okay, I want an agreement that you'll behave yourself at decorum. He said, that's all I ask, because I know you're fighting for your life. And he said she always kept her word, and he said, I've always respected her for that. And I was touched to hear this judge, who's now in his 80s, say that. And so she had great credibility in the court, and she did in the public because of the nature of the movement. And I hope one of the spinoffs from this petition for President Obama, and the name of it is Mamiya Abu-Jamal and the Global Abolition of the Death Penalty. It's a global effort.
And so what are you asking Obama to do?
I'm asking him to speak out. He cannot change what happens in this case. This is a state prosecution, even though we're in federal court. But he carries a lot of political capital. And what we want him to do is speak out on the issue of capital punishment that is wrong.
Well, and he's already spoken for capital.
It's not over until the fat lady sings.
Right.
And you know,
I admire lost causes are the only causes worth fighting for, right?
Cindy, yes, yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
And I will say that the people, once we have a certain number of signatures, which is quite a bit, but we'll get them. We have a very select group of people who present it to him who are world-renowned, and they're the kind of people who can get an audience with him.
And I know the past governors of Pennsylvania have not been sympathetic.
The present one's not
sympathetic. I was just about to ask you.
He said that he was one of the things he wanted to do while in office was to see Mamiya executed.
Oh, he's got so much against him. We really have to join together and work for
him. The power of the people is so important. I mean, my litigation, of course, is crucial, but I need an environment, a really strong movement. And the I mentioned at the top of the show recently, I was in Berlin to speak to 3,000 people. And during my speech, Mamiya called in. And people started, they wanted him, because he was standing in his death row cell, mm-hmm. and people wanted him to know that they cared. Mm-hmm. And so they started chanting for like 2 or 3 minutes, clapping and chanting, and he was in tears. But, you know, during that interview, and I talked to him on a speakerphone, my BlackBerry, so everybody could hear, during that, of the 3,000 people, I doubt if there were many dry eyes.
Right.
I mean, people were really touched because they were thinking, I'm sure, not just of him, but all of these men and women and children who were on death rows, both here and other countries. And again, this is him being a spokesperson. People could identify with this. And we really need to ignite the movement in this country and broaden it, much broader than it is.
Much broader.
And I want to see people prominent. There are some very prominent people like Ed Asner and so forth who are very supportive. But I want to see that grow. I want to see Salman Rushdie, the very prominent writer, people that ilk involved. E.L. Doctorow is a great writer. Is very supportive.
Rage Against the Machine.
Yes, absolutely.
And they really appeal to the younger people. You know, I think that's what we have happening. Mumia, like you said, has been on death row for almost 3 decades. And people get tired. People forget. We have to keep on reminding them. In this anti-war movement we have, people started before the war started, and people are tired. We can't get people out to anti-war events. We can't rally them to join us. So we don't have that much time left. Robert Brian, Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney, please tell my listeners again how they can sign this petition. And not just sign it, but pass it to your friends and have your friends pass it to their friends.
Pass the link. This is an online petition. You can get to it by MumiaLegalDefense.org, or just you can type in just MumiaLegal.org. And you'll see Mamiya's website, and on the left side is a petition. Just click there, and it will take you about 1 minute or less to sign it. And I just sent Mamiya yesterday the first 11,000 signatures. I printed them out, and they went for like 300 pages of signers, just so he could see, because he doesn't have access to something we take for granted, and that's just a computer.
Right.
And so he has no idea when I tell him what's going on. So I wanted him to see these people from around the world. And a lot of the people have comments. And folks, if you sign this at MumiaLegal.org, if you sign the petition, put a comment in if you feel so inclined. Some people write very touching comments about him. They talk about the death penalty, why it is wrong. As I was printing this out yesterday, I was going back through and reading some of these 11,000 comments, signatures, and some of the people's comments, and I was very moved by what the people were saying.
I'm sure you're going to get some really nasty ones too.
Because we got a few weird ones.
You just need to delete those. Yeah. If Mumia can keep his spirits up, we need to be out here working for him and helping him do that too.
And bear in mind, Cindy, that in fighting for him, it's really helping everybody.
Well, you know, every American, no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, should support justice. So, Robert, thank you for coming into the studio.
Well, thank you,
and
Cindy, I look forward to our eventual meeting, you meeting with Mamiya.
I can't wait. So we'll have to get that ball rolling. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Robert Brian, Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney. When we come back from this short break, we'll be hearing from Mumia. So stay tuned.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehanssoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehanssoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Today's rant is actually going to be from Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia has a podcast on prison radio, and today we're going to hear Mumia talking about Haiti. So these are the words right from Mumia Abu-Jamal's mouth.
Haiti on our minds. The recent natural disaster in Haiti has once again thrown Haiti into the eyes of the world and once again brought out both the best and the worst of us. The sheer scale of human suffering has evoked massive compassion as governments far and wide mobilize to assist those unable to assist themselves. Haiti, once the colonial era pearl of the Antilles, then the mother of revolutions, has suffered for nearly two centuries for daring to fight for and win its freedom from European colonialism and plunder. Haiti, we are informed by the corporate media, is the poorest nation in the West. We're never told, however, how it got that way. How many of us know that the U.S. brutally occupied Haiti and stayed there for over 20 years? Or that Haiti, which had the temerity to defeat not one, not two, but three colonial armies, the French, the British, and the Spanish, was forced to pay French reparations for nearly 200 years, the first and only time that a victor in war had to pay back the nation it defeated. Haiti isn't just poor. It's been impoverished by a global system of exploitation and a plantation capitalist economy that was designed as a sanction for black liberation. C.L.R. James, the great revolutionary scholar activist, has argued that the Haitian Revolution was a singular event in human history of more significance than either the French or American revolutions. In part, that's because the Haitian Revolution spelled the end to French imperialism in America. Napoleon, having lost his Haitian cash cow, sold vast lands to the U.S. for a song, doubling the size of the U.S. in one day. That an American preacher could today liken the event to the devil gives us some idea of its continuing power. Interestingly, neither of these other revolutions spelled an end to that truly demonic institution, slavery. Indeed, the reverse is true. For George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were slave owners, and Napoleon Bonaparte sent his army to Haiti to defend slavery. But an earthquake isn't a hurricane. It strikes suddenly, without warning. But many nations, like Japan, have constructed buildings which resist the bumps and whirls of earthquakes. Such techniques, if applied to Haitian schools, homes, and offices, could have greatly reduced loss of life and suffering. If it hadn't been bled and exploited for centuries, Haiti would have had the resources available to protect its people as much as possible. Let us hope that Haiti's future will be brighter than its post-colonial past. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Thank you, Mumia. Our Ask Cindy question comes from Gregory J. Lewis. And Gregory asked me, why did your son join the Army? Well, that's actually a very good question, Gregory, because there's many people on the so-called right of the political spectrum who think that everybody that joined the military, they join for some kind of sense of patriotism or revenge or wanting to serve your country in a violent way. That's what the military is about. Actually, most of our young people join the military because they think they have very little options. There's no jobs. There's no good paying jobs. There's no jobs with benefits. College is prohibitively expensive. It's very hard to work and work your way through college. And so it's a system designed to funnel our young people into the military. Casey very simply joined in May of 2000 to get help with his college education. And I am so opposed to our young people joining the military. A college education is not even in the balance scale of life. A college education doesn't even come anywhere near to equaling your life. So do whatever you can. Go to American Friends Service Committee website. That's American Friends Service Committee. And they have a ton of resources on how to avoid military service, how to help our young people get the education they need, get job training, find the resources they need to survive in a tough economy that their parents are finding hard to survive in. But we have to work together as a community to avoid having our children be used. October of 2009 was the first month in 6 years where our military met its recruitment goals, and that's solely because of the economy. I think maybe it might be a little bit because people have more of a trust in Obama. Obama is a person of color. As we know, most of the people who join the military are people of color. And I just say, you don't trust the man no matter what color that man is.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Well, that was our show today. I hope you really enjoyed it. I really urge you to go to peaceoftheaction.org, P-E-A-C-E of the action.org. That's your soapbox action for today. I want you to look at the videos of our protest last week, look at the pictures, and also look at our new website. We have a fabulous website, and Peace of the Action is starting on March 13th, so we need a lot of help. We need a lot of donations, so I hope you go to the website to see what you can do. Well, as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, my guest, Robert Bryan, and you for listening. I hope you tune in next week, and I hope next week we'll be talking about the United Citizens versus the Federal Election Commission. We'll talk to you next week.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.